From the Sky News Centre at 5, Julian Assange says having an investigation into a rape allegation against him dropped by Swedish authorities is an important victory, but it doesn't erase 7 years of detention without charge.
And almost 5 years here in this embassy without sunlight. Why my children grew up without me. That is not something that I can forgive. It is not something that I can forget.
The WikiLeaks founder has been speaking from the Ecuadorian embassy in London. The Metropolitan Police says he could still face arrest if he leaves over a breach of bail. The Prime Minister says devolution means different choices. She's been defending plans in the Scottish Tory manifesto to protect the winter fuel allowance for all Scottish pensioners. Theresa May yesterday announced plans to only give it to the most in need in England. Labour says it will lead to a choice between eating or heating for many. The PM says different regions can make conflicting decisions.
Well, we have devolution in the United Kingdom. As a government, we have given the Scottish Government significant powers in relation to welfare, and they make a number of decisions about various welfare benefits in Scotland.
A former Newcastle United coach has been charged with a string of 29 counts of sex offences. George Ormond from Devon is accused of committing the crimes over a 25-year period. An inquest has found a transgender woman who took her own life in a male prison wasn't given enough support. Vicky Thompson was found hanged in Leeds Prison in November 2015. Chris Cornell's wife says he might not have taken his own life and hinted he may have had more of an anti-anxiety drug than he was prescribed. Yesterday, a medical examiner in the US said suicide was the cause of the Soundgarden star's death. And Maria Sharapova says she won't request a wild card for Wimbledon as she continues her comeback from a drugs ban. She'll instead play the qualifying rounds. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. A Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, Helen Holland. Lib Dem councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, not just the two biggest unasked economic questions in this general election campaign, but two of the best books out there which can help us. That is to do with the financial crisis. Is it going to happen again? And also, there's another book out that's called Killing the Host, which is about the financial system actually killing the real economy while the virtual economy thrives. Also, where the banks learn from the international drug dealers that if they commit crime, they won't go to jail. They just have to pay a fine. Then they can make up the money to pay that fine at the touch of a button. And none of their directors or executives will go to jail. Also, an Israeli army defence force sergeant in Hebron blows the whistle. And what he now says is the endemic racism at the heart of the Israeli military policies. Domestically. And confirmation of the Bilderberg conference over in Chantilly. This is the secretive, very secretive NATO lobby, which seems to be a kind of kingmaker. People like Bill Clinton and Tony Blair go along to these meetings before they become party leaders or prime ministers or presidents. Also, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour. After six, we'll also be looking at the Iranian elections. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 7 Celsius, mainly dry. This weekend, highs of 16, sunshine and showers tomorrow, sunny spells though on Sunday. Next week, highs of 21, warmer, isn't it? Plenty of sunshine, but a few showers. Next weekend, 27th and 28th of May, is highs again, 21 and sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for Hartcliffe, Helen Holland, and Lib Dem councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. Hi, both of you. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello.
Hi.
First of all, with you, Helen, let's get your take on what's been going on with this Metro Mayor elections, because I think there's I think still out there a lot of questions about what is a Metro Mayor. And it almost, another big question in people's minds, and what's the point of having Marvin if he's got another mayor who's more important than him?
Well, you can understand people's confusion, and I think when we've talked about this before, I've suggested that actually if you think that a sub-regional level is the right level to make decisions about big infrastructure projects, which it probably is, that one of the big things that the government could have done, apart from obviously imposing this model and insisting that the person was called a mayor, would have been to have called them a regional commissioner or something like that. That would just have been a little bit easier for people to understand the difference between the Metro Mayor, the mayor, and of course in our case, Anthony and I have been in lots of debates about this in the council chamber in Bristol. We've got three mayors because we've got a Lord Mayor as well. So you can absolutely understand people's confusion. And I think the important thing to focus on here is that these are decisions, and this is how I think we should keep it at the moment, is that these are decisions that were previously made behind closed doors, if you like, in civil servant departments, Department for Transport largely, in London, without people really being able to have any transparency about what made governments of the day, whatever colour, choose those projects to back. And those projects hopefully will be decided and be much more transparent and accountable because they're made at a local level. And that any of the powers from the three councils that are part of this new arrangement that are passed up, that has to absolutely be with the agreement of the three councils, and the Metro Mayor shouldn't try to suck up powers that are currently within the democratic accountability of the three councils.
But I mean, it seems to me that councillors, Anthony, are having less and less power all the time. And we've heard, quite a lot of power taken away by the mayor, who makes most of the important decisions himself. And now even more powers going away from the city council with the Metro Mayor. Anyway, can you sum up for us, what is a Metro Mayor and what do you make of all this?
You're asking me what a Metro Mayor... Well, a Metro Mayor certainly is not someone responsible for Metro Bus and Metro Rail, which a lot of people seem to think it is. It is a construct by government, and it's the ticket price for giving a grant to the sub-region to manage things. And I think Helen and I probably were on the same side of that debate that we had about why we're doing this. We all, I think, supported the money and what that money might be used for and the good works that it could do. And I think we probably both agreed, I'm looking sideways, that we needed something which is more of an overview than perhaps just the individual authorities. And I was happy enough with that. But of course, we had that in the past. We had the West of England organisation, and the work didn't come down. I'm sorry, Helen, but better have a bit of controversy. It didn't come down necessarily on high. It was discussed and very well presented. One of the best committees I've ever served on. I served on it for 2.5 years. That looked about the strategic opportunities, and it's those very things that the Metro Mayor is now picking up. Agree the money is coming much more directly to that organisation rather than us have to keep bidding for it and scratching people's backs in order to get it. But nevertheless, it is doing very much the same thing, and it is regrettable, I think, that we've had to pay this price of having a mayor in order to achieve this income.
So we've had a few weeks. Has the Metro Mayor actually done anything? I've had a look for any news stories or anything to do. It doesn't seem like there's anything come out at all.
To be fair, it's only, 10 days, is it? Or so?
Two weeks, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it would be unlikely that things would have happened in that time. But I think one of the things...
Well, or an announcement. Announcement isn't too difficult, is it?
No. But in future programmes, I think it would be very good if you could explore, first of all, the accountability. And I think, again, that's something that Anthony and I would share concerns about. How is the Metro Mayor's... role and decision making going to be scrutinised? And I think in that it's absolutely essential, and again I would sorry to do this on you and agree all the time, but, you know, I'd agree with Anthony that when that's been best, it's been when there's been cross-boundary and cross-party committee that's looked at the work of the West of England Local Enterprise Partnership and the West of England Partnership. But also it's about making sure that there isn't a big bureaucracy going to be set up by the new Metro Mayor, that we don't need a parallel bureaucracy, because the three councils that are part of it have that already, and we can feed into that, and we don't want lots of extra people paid big salaries to run the Metro Mayor's office.
Well, one thing that is a bit concerning about all this is that most of the staff of the Metro Mayor have just simply been moved from the Local Enterprise Partnership over to work for the Metro Mayor. And the Local Enterprise Partnership was being constantly, at least on this show, with most people who were coming on here whenever it comes up, saying, well, yes, but it's all very well, but it's just not accountable. What they're effectively doing is they're taking public money and giving it to their own pet projects. I mean, for example, over in Weston-super-Mare, we've seen Weston College buy up the winter gardens and use the development money to refurbish their own, effectively what is now their own, they bought it for £1, I think. But the money that the LEP, Local Enterprise Partnership, was spending, a lot of it was going on their own pet projects, and there wasn't a lot of accountability, and yet that staff has now been moved over to work for the Metro Mayor.
Well, if that means that that money and that initiative and all the rest is going to be much more accountable, I would certainly agree with that. And one of my great objections to the LEP was that it was always a very obscure body that was very, very difficult to understand, gave out the information they wanted us to hear.
Well,
and
which was nothing.
Else.
When I phoned them up, they wouldn't tell me anything.
Okay. I'm certainly not going to go down the track of where they put money into their pet projects, but it was certainly very difficult to understand what was happening and what the priorities were. But coming back to your first point, to be honest, I don't necessarily want lots of razzmatazz and headlines and everything else coming out of the Metro Mayor's office. I want to get stuff done. Mm-hmm. We all know what needs to be done. We all know what we've been unable to do because of restrictions
and various other things.
Well, we want primarily, absolutely, first and foremost, let's get rid of this problem that we've got, which is that in order to have better control of our public transport system, or public in inverted commas, but there's our mass transport system, then we needed an agreement between more than just one authority, and that was rather difficult to achieve. The Metro Mayor is in all of the hustings and everything else, was very much charged and asked that question many times: are you going to take this and make sure we bang some sense into everybody and get a system that allows us to have much more control over what we want as a sub-region and individual unitary authorities within that sub-region, what we need for a mass transit system. And we have an appalling system in Bristol right now, and it can only get better. And this is a way, I hope, of getting it better. And if there is going to be an announcement, I'd very much like that to be the first one.
So I think there were many people sitting in their cars out there right now who probably say exactly the same to you. Helen, what do you make of the fact that actually Leslie Mansell didn't win, did she? I mean, this is from a Bristol, which is a generally Labour voting. Most of the constituencies in Bristol are Labour. You would have expected potentially anyway to have a Labour Metro Mayor, but that didn't happen, did it?
Well, I think Leslie's result was very good, actually. Of course, it's a pity that she didn't win, but she was within a whisker, really. And when you think of the colour of the two surrounding authorities, then, you know, it was a mountain to climb, and she did very, very well. I think there was a lot of talk in the first place about that Labour wasn't going to do well. There were an awful lot of very misleading graphs, as I understand it, on documentation going out from other parties. But Leslie put up a very good fight, and I think that when I saw the count and the declaration, that you could see that Tim Bowles had respect for Leslie, and that was a good outcome. But of course, you know, Labour does not control either South Gloucestershire or Bath and North East.
So I suppose if you look at it that way, she did reasonably well. I mean, Martin Summers, I wonder if you can just chip in here, because it does seem as if one of the it's almost like a little trick that's been played on us, this Metro Mayor business in cities around the country, where what you do is you take many of the cities, of course, are Labour controlled. You expand the city out sort of 30 miles around or whatever into the stockbroker belt and Tory heartland, and then the Conservatives control that city from there on with the Metro Mayor.
Well, I don't think it's the case with the Metro Mayor, because this has been explained by other people. It's actually got a very limited brief of what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to be coordinating between three existing authorities. It's a bit of a dog's breakfast, because, of course, North Somerset, for their own Conservative reasons, didn't want to be part of it.
I think wasn't part of anything.
Yeah. Well, I think in the long run, they may feel that they'll have to come in on board if it's successful. I think what's interesting is that we had a transferable vote here. And if Steve Williams had come second, it's quite possible he would have beaten the Tory, because he would have got more transfer votes from...
I think it's inevitable. Yeah, if he'd come second, he would have won.
Yeah, and I think that similar things...
How does that sounds like a very complicated voting system. If you come second, you win.
The second vote. Yeah. Most of the second preferences would have gone to Stephen Williams. And on the doorstep, it was absolutely clear that everyone was voting second for Stephen. And some people were saying, I'm very sorry, we're not going to vote for him first this time. But of course you've got our second vote. And that was a very, very common response. And when you think of it, Stephen was, I can't remember now, 3,000 or something away from Leslie, 1,500 votes from her to Stephen, and he would have been in second and would be sitting as Metro Mayor now.
Well, that's the problem. It's a semi-proportional system. So, in other words, you've got to guess who's going to get into the second. It's a bit like the French elections.
There's a top slicing, which is
you still have to do tactical voting.
You do, and I think that you know, actually, people were telling people on the doorstep, give us your second vote. And I think for a lot of people, that concept about, well, this is the person I prefer, but I've got to think about what the what ifs.
Yeah, I think the tactical voting, just to butt in, I think the tactical voting only came in with a second vote. Mm. I think people got a chance to vote for their first preference, and then for their second. Some people would have realised they would not have made the top two anyway, and that's a different decision entirely. But those people that felt they were in with a chance of being in the top two then had a second chance of a tactical vote. In other words, stopping somebody else.
Okay, let's broaden our wings here a little bit. No, Martin, let's broaden our wings a little bit, right? And look at one of the major news stories today, which is Julian Assange, who says he's defiant as the rape probe against him is dropped. WikiLeaks founder says he will not forgive or forget that his name was slandered. Now, this is a long-running story. He's been in the Ecuadorian embassy for 5 years. With you first, perhaps this time, Anthony, what do you make of what has happened now? The Swedes have said, oh, actually, no, we're going to drop this rape charge against you. Actually, I don't think he had even been charged, had he? They wanted to investigate it, but there were no actual charges in Sweden against him.
He had an arrest warrant against him, I believe, which meant that he was going to be called in to examine stories or whatever, and they believed they had the right to subpoena him effectively.
Okay, so what would you make of the wider thing?
Well,
he's one of the most important publishers
talking
in the
about
world.
Slander at the moment. I'm not going to say a great deal. I can tell you.
Well, he's one of the most important publishers in the world.
For sure, but that shouldn't mean that anyone is exempt or much easier to treat with kid gloves. It's interesting that instead of facing those charges, he decided to run for cover in a very strange place.
Well, do you think he was
darkened room.
That maybe the Americans wanted to get him from Sweden?
I guess that he probably ran for cover more because of his concerns about what the Americans were trying to get him for rather than the allegations in Sweden. And certainly from what he's saying today, it appears, and I've not read this story in great detail, it appears that that's exactly his view, that this is that these charges were trumped up in order, sorry, forgive the pun, before him, in fact, long before him. But these charges were brought in order to make him vulnerable to be picked up for something else, which was a political situation rather than anything else.
Helen, do you have any sympathy for Assange, who's been in the Ecuadorian embassy now for 5 years, and the Swedes have now dropped this rape probe against him?
I don't really, and it's for the reasons that Anthony said, that when the charges were made, you would have thought that somebody who has, you know, made their name about that more stuff should be transparent, that he would have faced them. And I, again, like Anthony, I don't really want to say a lot more about this particular case, but I understand from listening to the news as I came here this evening that the police here have still said that if he was to leave the embassy, they would arrest him because of him breaking bail conditions. So the one thing that's certain is that this story isn't over, and there will be long, protracted legal cases, and they will still involve, I'm guessing, Sweden, this country, and the US.
Martin, it seems to be this case of Assange somewhere between Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. Now, Edward Snowden managed to get well out of the way with the information he was leaking. Chelsea Manning didn't, and has done time for it. In fact, has actually been released early, very much. I mean, I think it was something like four lifetime sentences he got for releasing information to the public. But this is all about stuff... all about stuff from the heart of the US intelligence system, which, of course, we're all rather interested in what they're up to.
Well, I think Assange, the fact that that the Swedes have dropped what wasn't, in fact, a charge against him, and he's still going to have to stay in the embassy, suggests that the people have got it in for him. It's quite interesting because some of the leaks that WikiLeaks made were deemed to be pro-Trump, in the sense that they helped Trump, and Trump was quite positive about WikiLeaks, and now he's suddenly decided he hates Assange and he's got to be arrested. But, of course, one of the main things that WikiLeaks leaked was that was the information about the Democratic National Committee rigging the primaries against Bernie Sanders. And of course the source for that was coming out in the last 48 hours was Seth Rich, who was the IT guy on the DNC, and he was murdered. And of course this is all running around on the internet now. And of course Craig Murray, the former British ambassador, went to the US to pick up the stuff from the whoever leaked it to WikiLeaks. And of course all of the evidence shows that it wasn't the Russians, it was an insider who leaked it because they were fed up with the shenanigans going on within the Democratic Party. And Seth Rich looks as if he was, and of course Assange and various other people have put forward, have put money up to find the murderer of Seth Rich, because he was murdered and he was supposedly a robbery that went wrong, but they didn't take anything from him, including his laptop and all the rest of it. But anyway, this is all out there running around. But let's just say that there's an awful lot more going out there than people realise. And the Ecuadorian embassy, of course, the Ecuadorian left-wing Lenin Moreno has just won the presidential election in Ecuador, so they're bucking the trend of left-wing governments falling in Latin America. They've still got a left-wing government in Ecuador.
Well, they're asking for safe passage for Assange to Ecuador now.
Ecuador is from the very beginning of saying, we'll just let him come to Ecuador, but the British won't let him leave the embassy.
Why not?
Well, you better ask the British.
Why do you think?
Well, I think it's because the Americans tell us what to do and then we do what they say.
Well, if anyone wants to sort of look into the origins of this, that is to say the arrest warrant, Anthony's quite right, but no actual charges against Assange from Sweden for rape. There's a documentary on ABC television, abc.net.au online. You can watch it online. The Four Corners documentary series over in Australia called Sex, Lies and Julian Assange, which really goes into detail about what these allegations originally were. If you're not familiar with that, you can watch it online. I'll put a link up to our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Now, in case you hadn't noticed, there's a general election campaign going on. I'm not allowed to have candidates in unless I make sure everybody is here. And next week at this time, we will have all of the candidates for all the main candidates for the Bristol West constituency, which Thangam Debonair is fighting to retain. Except at the moment, it looks as if Thangam herself won't be here. So we'll be having the Lib Dems, the Conservatives, the Greens without Labour, which is a great pity. But anyway, I hope Thangam can manage to make it for next week. So what have you two been seeing, maybe you first, Helen, on the doorsteps? Because you're obviously knocking on people's doors. What are the main issues that they're bringing up at the moment in this general election campaign?
Well, I've been out today and I can tell you that the threat to the winter fuel allowance has come up time and time again this morning. And I think that, it's very interesting that a Conservative Party which has relied on in many cases, the votes of older people has suddenly done something which has certainly threatened their, you know, their continued support in that older generation. And I think it's either that they feel so confident that they're going to be re-elected on June the 8th that they think that they can do things that undermine that vote from older people, or it's, you know, a very kind of misplaced policy.
Anthony, what do you make of things, issues which have been coming up during this campaign?
I don't know whether
voters, from voters.
I don't know if we're a magnet for this, but most people are talking about Brexit. Certainly, that comes up in most of the conversations that we have.
Is it an election about Brexit?
It is, and I think that's why, as soon as people see my clipboard with an emblazoned Liberal Democrat sign on it, they know that they want to talk to me or our canvassers about Brexit.
So they want a second referendum, do they?
It's a lot of views, I have to say, but certainly a lot of dissatisfaction about the way things are going, and particularly about the prospect of having what could very well be either a bad deal or absolutely no deal at all, both of which will be horrendous for this country. I mean, the next 2 years, and we've already seen it in the preceding year with the way the pound's collapsed and confidence has gone down and people are all scrabbling to get out and all the rest, that's bad enough. We've got another 2 years of this with a grind before it goes, which is obviously why Theresa May took the, you know, it changed everything she'd ever said and went for an early election, because in 2020... this is going to be horrendous. I mean, the Conservatives might be wiped out for a generation as a result of what comes out of these poor negotiations. We've got very little leeway on this with the way it's going, and we have, and it is just the Liberal Democrats, and people understand that, who are prepared to stand up and try and make sure that we get a better deal out of all of this. But I mean, somebody said to me the other day, and I will repeat it because it flustered me at first. She said, "Look, if you were flogging me a piece of electrical equipment, I could." And telling me how wonderful it is, when I unpacked it inside, if I didn't like it, I could go back and send it back and blooming well get to choose. Now I've seen it, it's in my hands, and what it does and doesn't do, I could get to send it back.
Yeah, but
and that's absolutely right.
Isn't that what we're doing with the European Economic Community, the EU? We've joined it in 1973, and we're now saying, hey, thank you very much, we've had enough of that.
But it's changed greatly since 1973, and our role in it has changed greatly. In fact, one of the reasons that I felt very strongly about staying in the EU was the ability of Britain to make a difference within the EU, and there were signs that other countries were sort of getting a bit of that as well. And now we're out of it. We've actually lost that chance.
But, I mean, surely just
not
before...
to be part of the biggest market in the world, but and people with whom we've, you know, we actually have a cultural identity, we've actually missed the chance to make things better.
Surely just before the vote, David Cameron, this is at the beginning of last year, went over to try and get as better deal as he could, and he got nothing, basically. He came back with virtually nothing.
Well, then the writing should have been on the wall, shouldn't it? And some of the stuff that we had from the Leave people, 350 million quid, you know, on a battle bus, which when pointed out by almost everybody, including BBC Radio's fact finders or checklist or whatever they were called, they refused to take that off their bus and still kept peddling that lie.
Anyway,
around the country.
Helen,
but this is what we're up
against. Used to be the Conservatives that were tying themselves up in knots over Brexit. Now it seems to be the Labour Party with a commitment this week saying that there will be an end to free movement, and yet you want to stay in the single market. So how do you square that? Am I right? I mean, that seems to be impossible.
Well, I think that the first thing to say is that we accept, a lot of us, like myself, very unhappy with it, but accept that the vote has been taken a year ago, and the country has spoken. I mean, it was a lot more marginal than some people make out now. They make it sound as if it was an overwhelming vote, and it absolutely wasn't. But this, you know, no deal, no deal is better than a bad deal, is clearly nonsense. for the reasons, again, that Anthony has said. We've already had a huge effect on the British economy, and people can see that, and it does come up on the doorstep. Again, I was talking to somebody this morning in my ward about it, and he feels very strongly that he was telling me that he voted to stay in, his brother voted to go out, and the conversations that they'd had within their family. But I think the idea that we could say that we'll sign up to no deal without knowing what the impact of that is going to be. And I think, again, it's not just about the economy, but it is about influencing some of those bigger global questions, isn't it? Like environmental legislation, yeah. That actually our little country doing something, even if we managed to clean up the air and only use clean energy, it wouldn't make a huge impact on the global climate change question, would it? But working with those partners and the additional pressure that we're able to put on through working with our European partners, we surely need to find a way to keep the best of that. And I think I was told, I'm doing this figure from memory, but there are 42,000 pieces of legislation that affect local government alone. Perhaps I've got the figure wrong there, but it wouldn't be surprising, would it? So actually, are we really going to, in 2 years, going to go through each of those and decide which ones we want and which ones we don't?
It's just a question of how we're going to be out.
But both on environmental protection, on workers' rights, on a whole range of things. There are things that Europe has been able to, that we've benefited by that collective action by being with our European partners that have made this country better.
Well, we're not actually floating off into the Atlantic, even though some people seem to think we are. We're still going to be here, folks. And there's still going to be a Channel Tunnel. I don't think they're going to be concreting it up quite yet.
I just
want to go on to mention the... there's a programme BBC Two are making, and Helen brought up this whole thing of economy starting to sink after Brexit, apparently. BBC Two have just... They had the BAFTAs earlier this week, and one of the companies, Keo Films, that won the BAFTA for giving cameras to refugees and migrants coming across the Atlantic, won a film for an amazing film called Exodus that went out last year on BBC. I'm not sure if it was BBC or Channel 4, but anyway, they won BAFTA for it. But they're back, and they're making a film at the moment, and... producer of the film, her name is Shell, is going to be in Bristol. Well, she's in Bristol today, and she's going to be around tomorrow. And she'd like to hear from anybody around in the city who's got strong views about or has experienced this whole business of low income and having to survive on virtually nothing. The film is looking at this whole aspect that the Joseph Rowntree Trust have dug out, which is that work is often now not a route out of poverty. So you can get yourself a job, and then you find you're just as bad in the same kind of situation, still going to food banks, as you were before. So let's have a little quick listen to Shell now.
We've been quite shocked already in some of the research we've done visiting various food banks around the country. And we've come across nurses, police officers, all sorts of people, drivers. And it just really feels like everywhere in all the four corners of the UK and in all different professions, people are just finding it really difficult to keep their head above water. So we're interested in telling a range of different stories, trying to explore what it's like to sort of survive on low income in Britain today. And I think it's coming at a good time with all that's going on in sort of the political backdrop with various cuts, rises in prices. And obviously we'll be putting it in context, but at this stage we're really just looking to hear from people and hear their personal experiences of how they're finding life in Britain on low income today.
So that's Shell Coe, who's making that film. She's really in the initial stages of researching it at the moment. But if you want to have a chat with her, she's around Bristol this evening and tomorrow. She's on 07465 733 735. That's 07465 733 735. If you've got a story to tell, or if you just, I suppose, want to unburden your soul and have a chat with her. I do hope that they have some of these... nurses and police that are having to go to food banks, Anthony, at the moment, on their programme when it finally comes out. Because this is pretty shocking, isn't it?
It's shocking if anyone has to revert to a food bank. Of course it is. And some of the things that have happened over the last 2 years at least with with this government, and some of the changes that they've made even in the last 12 months have made that much more likely. And we would certainly believe in taking the cap off public pay, changing the way that universal credit works, particularly for working families, and easing some of those things like childcare and some of the other problems that people have in that situation. These are all things very high on our shopping list of things to get better. I mean, one of the insulting things is to actually make the nurses that you refer to actually make the nurses withdrawing nurses' bursaries, making them having to pay for their own training, is just unspeakable.
Ellen?
Well, it's shocking, isn't it, how the low regard that this government appears to have for people in public service. Mm. And you think about the cuts in schools and the threat of the education funding cuts that could possibly be coming forward if the Tories do win on June the 8th, that it just seems to me that those people who we used to really look up to in society, the police, nurses, teachers, that the Tories' view is everything is marketable, that we carry on driving it down. And we see this within the council. You know, we've had to, because of the cuts that have been forced on us, lose so many people. And the workloads of the people who are there, and I'm sure the same is true across the rest of public service, that it is just astonishing. And I think we've got to say enough is enough, and you have got to fund public services properly. Because what comes back to me time and time again, and actually this isn't just in public service, but voluntary sector organisations, charitable organisations, who do a huge amount in this city, is that you can pare down so much. And sometimes in the past there have been bad times and people have reduced their level of service, but then when the times have been better, they've been able to expand again. But you begin to think, what is going to be left that when times improve, we will be able to build these services up again?
Well, look,
and the idea that we'll actually, you know, that the expectation would be that you'll pay for more of your medical services, pay for more of education services, is frankly wrong.
Look, the pitchforks are going to be out tomorrow on College Green, apparently. Parents, teachers and children, well, rubber pitchforks maybe, to gather on Saturday, that's tomorrow, for a huge protest against budget cuts to schools in the Bristol area. A series of meetings have been held in Bristol and South Gloucestershire to discuss how the government's proposed national funding formula will affect schools here. The city's schools face some £32 million of cuts to their budgets, while those in the neighbouring area face £12 million deficit. That means Bristol could lose about 1,000 teachers, while schools in South Gloucestershire could make 300 teachers redundant. Protests will see hundreds of people coming to College Green from 11 a.m. Speakers will address the crowd to explain what they can do as part of the NFF consultation, expected to march down to Harbourside and towards Broadmead before coming back to College Green. So there's some sort of rally around about 11 and the march starting at 11:30. Martin Summers, you were working in a school until recently and you've been cut, haven't you?
Well, yes. Obviously, there's a real problem with public expenditure and the attitude of the government. I think
so. If you were up on College Green, what would you be saying tomorrow?
Well, I mean, we shouldn't really be cutting public expenditure at all, actually. And of course, we've given up on getting the deficit down. Do you remember the deficit that we had to get down? We don't have to get it down anymore because we've supposedly gone through the pain now, and now we're just talking about the future. But of course, that's all wrong. In fact, the deficit's still there; it's not been taken away since the Tories were first in power. Can I just mention what really worries me, or not worries me, but I think there's something that people need to focus on, is the whole question of mandates. There was a mandate to leave the European Union based on the referendum that we talked about. But, of course, when the Scots voted for devolution in 1979, Northern Ireland. The Scots voted for devolution, but because they didn't get 55%, they had to wait another 10 years, I think, before they could get what they wanted.
Well, they may get a vote before that.
Well, yes, and, of course, in Northern Ireland, of course, people didn't vote to leave the European Union any more than they did in Scotland. And, of course, when it comes to the the actual general election, which is on the first past the post, it could very well be that Theresa May will not have the support of the majority of the population for whatever she wants to do. Not that she's going to tell us, because she just said, just trust me. But of course, every other negotiator she'll be dealing with, including the Taoiseach from Ireland and all the other countries in the European Union, every single one of those people will have a mandate of at least 50% plus one. She won't, because the British system is broken, and I'm sure Anthony will agree with me about this.
Well,
this is a problem.
What I will certainly say is that it seems incompatible that someone would talk about the rosy future just around the corner when we sort out these negotiations. It's all going to end well, and yet everything is desperately being cut. All the commitments about the triple lock, all the talks about, well, the recent fiasco with national insurance, the cuts to the NHS, the cuts to education, which I'm sure, remembering what I read of Helen's manifesto, ours certainly will be recovering those cuts.
Look,
but she is clearing the ground for a really bad result here.
We had a referendum on the alternative vote, didn't we? I think it was the 2010 election at the same time, and the public voted against it. So that's why we're in the situation we are. Anyway, let me just get on to the...
You know why that was.
The manifesto.
You know why that was. It's because it was completely changed from what most people wanted, which was a simple PR system, changed into something massively complicated.
It was a halfway house towards PR.
And then, because it was massively complicated,
anyway, look,
everybody
said no. We've had the launch of the two main parties' manifestos this week. So what I've done is I had to listen through all these. Crikey, it was driving me crazy because they're quite long. To try and find the bits where they were actually talking about policies, because there was loads of stuff about strong, safe, all this kind of thing, and Brexit and various things about how Britain's going to be wonderful, etc. But to actually get them to talk about policies. So let's start with Tuesday and Jeremy Corbyn's launching his manifesto, which was leaked, of course, previously. And this, I think, is the best part, which talks about actually what he's going to do, which is what I wanted to hear.
Labour is guaranteeing the triple lock to protect pensioners' incomes. And we will build over 1 million new homes, at least half of them for social rent. Labour makes no apology for offering new protections to people at work, including ending the scandal of zero-hours contracts. And we make no apology for finding the resources to hire 10,000 new police officers and 3,000 new firefighters. And we will do the smaller things that can make a real difference, like ending hospital car parking charges or introducing four extra public holidays every year. But we in the Labour Party recognise that dealing with and solving these problems requires a thriving economy, one that gets our economy working again and rises to the challenges of Brexit on jobs and investment. For 7 years, the Conservatives have been holding Britain back. Low investment, low wages, low growth. Labour will move Britain forward with ambitious plans to unlock this country's potential. We will set up a national investment bank and regional development banks to finance growth and good jobs for all parts of the United Kingdom.
So that's Jeremy Corbyn, 2.5 minutes or so from him. Now, Helen, I wonder what you'd like to pick out as the sort of main things that Jeremy Corbyn is pushing in the Labour Party in this general election? Because I think the thing is, it's always difficult because there's so much to look at. I mean, just looking at one of these, I mean, you've got one there, haven't you? You've got the actual manifesto there. It's like, do people really want to read a book? No, they don't. They just want to know, what are they going to do for me?
Yeah, they don't want to read a book. You're right. And the attraction of sitting reading manifestos, I'm surprised that you've found the time, Tony, to do it with across the major parties. But what people want to hear, and we've already referred to it, is that we are going to invest in public services. So the things that are very popular are things like the extra police officers. They are things like renationalising the railways. They are things like building homes. And I realise that the Tories this week have said that they're going to build homes, but there's absolutely nothing behind the claim that they've made. And we know that part of that, even when it's social housing, is that they're going to make social housing tenancies even more vulnerable than they currently are. So people want to hear that we've got the kind of policies that invest in this country, and making work pay actually is a real thing, isn't it? When people aren't going to find themselves working but still drawing benefits. So those things are very popular. And I was saying to somebody the other day when we had the manifesto launch, the real one, not the leaked one, that there was nothing that even people who might not agree with the Labour Party about everything, but there was very little that people could disagree with, because they could see that it was all very sensible and put public service back at the heart of this country.
Anthony, for the Lib Dems, isn't your manifesto sort of halfway between Conservative and Labour somewhere, just sort of exactly pitched like that?
It's a popular belief that the Liberal Democrats are always halfway between absolutely anybody, and that's completely untrue. We're a radical party and always have been, and in terms of the only serious commitment that seemed to come out of the Tory manifesto, which was an ability for local authorities to borrow money in a certain way to build homes. This is something which the local government organisation, pretty well every local authority that has any social housing in its remit, has been asking for years and years. This is a grudging a grant which is heavily curtailed and then still requires selling off in a short time. This is not a solution. The third party manifesto, the major one that was launched this week, which was the Liberal Democrat manifesto, is 100 pages long. I can't, probably different size pages to the one that Helen's is, but nevertheless.
Can you tease out the most important
points? It is substantial. Well, what I'm going to pick out is many of the things that are restoring some of the worst excesses of what the Tories have done, including all the cuts they made to all the achievements we did, with one exception, all the achievements we did in the coalition, all the good things, the 76% of the policy that came out in those 5 years acknowledged by the Conservative Party, which was Liberal Democrat policy in the coalition, all of those things were cut by the Conservatives, with one was cut actually this week, which was school dinners. And they actually cut school dinners. But the only one that's been left is pupil premium. We're looking to raise that pupil premium substantially for early learning, and that's the one thing. Helen was also at the meeting, the briefing I was at in Bristol City Council. That's the one thing that's keeping some of our schools afloat, is the pupil premium. Everything else the Tories are stripping back and cutting away. And we have a raft of policies here, all of which are sensible. The most important thing is that these are credible. They're all completely costly.
I mean,
can you really trust the Labour Party to deliver very good things without getting us in an awful financial mess?
You've had a lot of problems in elections since the coalition, that people just see you as kind of propping up the Conservatives from that coalition government still.
Actually, on the doorstep, you asked me earlier what we found on the doorstep, and I promise you this is true. In 2015, when I canvassed, people were saying just that. I'm having two things coming back to me now. One is that an acceptance that the coalition was actually managed to get some good stuff done and certainly managed to arrest some of the worst things the Tories have done since. And secondly, there's been a lot of credit given to Nick Clegg, and that's the first time I've ever heard Nick Clegg resurrected. And that's, I think, a sign that people actually believe good things came out of that time and that, that things are not as bad as they might be.
Well, we see him on the hear him anyway on the radio, and he seemed quite a lot of Nick Clegg still. Anyway, let's go now to Theresa May, who launched the Conservative manifesto yesterday, and hear some of the policies from her, because most of it was really seemed to be about Brexit and about everything being kind of strong and stable. In fact, that term was so many times, it must have been 20 times it was used in the speech, which I couldn't quite believe. Also, the speech a bit different character to that of Jeremy Corbyn, with no applause apart from at the end. Certainly didn't seem to be any sort of cheering and shouting, whereas Jeremy Corbyn tries to sort of come across as a bit of a rock star. Theresa May was very much not like that. Anyway, so let's have a listen to Theresa May. 2.5 minutes of her, 2.5 minutes of her policies now.
With the right Brexit deal secured, my mainstream government will deliver for mainstream Britain. All those who work hard and make this country what it is. People who have a job but don't always have job security. People who own their home but worry about paying the mortgage. People who can just about manage but worry about the cost of living and getting their children into a good school. And that is why the government I lead will ensure that every area of this United Kingdom is able to prosper with a modern industrial strategy to spread opportunity across the whole country. Why the government I lead will build a Britain in which work pays, with a higher national living wage and proper rights and protections at work. Why the government I lead will keep taxes low and cap rip-off energy tariffs to help families who are working all the hours they can to pay the bills. Why we will help those struggling to afford a home of their own by building more affordable homes. It's why the government I lead will build a Britain in which the economy is strong to support world-class public services, with the most ambitious programme of investment in technology and buildings the NHS has ever seen. Record and fair funding for schools, real technical education for young people, and the first ever proper plan to pay for and provide social care. Because strong public services don't just provide security and enhance opportunity, they are vital local and national institutions that bring us all together. And it is why the government I lead will be relentless in tackling burning injustices like discrimination on the basis of race, gender, mental health or disability. For injustice is a scar on the soul of our nation, and I will fight it wherever it is found. So, for example, we will introduce the first new mental health bill for 30 years to put parity of esteem at the heart of treatment and end the stigma of mental illness once and for all. But most important of all, the government I lead will provide strong and stable leadership to see us through Brexit and beyond, tackling the long-term challenges we face and ensuring everyone in our country has the chance to get on in life.
Well, she's certainly the front runner in this general election, but Anthony, I saw you shaking your head in despair there.
Well, no mention of the word conservative. I thought it was quite interesting in all of that. Much about I and leading and...
Well, to be fair, that was just a little extract from the longer
speech. Yes, but I've
speech.
Had, like most other people in Britain, have had leaflets from the Theresa May party, which has red all over it and doesn't mention conservatives at all, because conservatives is probably well known as a fairly dirty word.
Is this the Theresa May election rather than the Conservative
election? Absolutely. And I'm hoping that the next clip you're going to have is sort of Tim Farron, who gave an unbelievably rousing speech. I nearly stood up in the middle of it at Arnold Feeney during the Metromayor campaign recently. But so I'm
would
waiting,
you like to do
I'm
your imitation?
But there won't be. No. Of course I'm not going to do an imitation. No one can quite imitate. When Tim Farron's on, I can tell you, no one can catch up with him. He's superb. But You're quite right, there was just a little bit of polite tickle of applause at the end of it. But you've got to remember all these things are fully constructed. And that's the expectation that Theresa May would have, a very reverential, presidential style response to her her announcements.
You mean American style?
I think so. I mean, the party's being expunged. It's all about her. She's trying to create a new image. And yet she is not talking about the essential things like putting £7 billion into education and £6 billion into health and social care, all fully costed, all identified as it is in our policies. She's not saying any of that.
The hypocrisy of having to listen to that, I've really found it very hard. The, you know, help for people who are only just managing when they've just announced the potential to lose the winter fuel allowance. Energy cap, which when Ed Miliband had that as a policy a couple of years ago, was seen as a barking lefty policy that you couldn't possibly have and would destroy the market that the big six energy companies have. These things people know when they hear her talk about the esteem that mental health should have the same esteem as physical health. But when the cuts are coming through the health service, when she talked about supporting technology, I think it was, in the NHS, when we know that many of the trusts who were hit by the cyber attack last week actually talked about, because of the cuts on their trusts, they hadn't been able to update their IT systems. This is pure hypocrisy. And we know that if they are to be elected, that the continuing austerity on public services will bite even worse than it bites now.
Martin Summers, your thoughts on this, because it does seem a little bit like Anthony is hinting there, is that some of the techniques used in US elections are now coming over here, and it's becoming much more about Theresa May, almost like the cult of personality, rather than the party she represents and the policies.
Well, this is Lynton Crosby, isn't it? The dirty digger behind her campaign. I come back to the point I made earlier. The problem for Theresa May is she's got to get 50% plus one, because we're now in referendum land. She's going to have to negotiate with the Irish. They will have 50% plus one.
She doesn't get in, does she?
No, she doesn't under the British system.
No,
but everybody
that's
else,
the system everyone
everybody
is
else,
to
yes,
work
and
with,
one of
Martin.
The problems in America is that Trump didn't win the election.
It's the system everyone
Trump
has
didn't win
to
the election
with.
In the United States of America. Hillary Clinton won it,
it's
but
about,
under the system,
who,
Trump becomes the president.
It's about who gets in. It's not about what,
Tony, the point is, it's about democracy, Tony, and in actual fact in some countries there isn't any democracy because the system's rigged.
Well,
the United States of America is one of them, and Britain is another.
Indeed.
But unfortunately, or fortunately in fact, Ireland isn't. And the first thing that Theresa May is going to have to deal with when she's elected, if she's elected, is the Irish question. Does everybody realise that? Because that's what everybody else in Europe is going to be asking, the Irish question.
You were nodding there, Anthony.
Well, obviously, I'd agree with democracy. It's part of the party title. It's the stuff of which we've made. It's fundamental that if we really are going to get people to believe in this system and support it and vote in greater numbers, they've actually got to believe that their vote is going to count, and it's not going to count with this rotten system that we've had,
Helen,
for a very long time.
What do you make of this? Because actually the first past the post system actually does favour Labour, doesn't it?
Well, I don't think it does, and I think one of the other things that we can see is, you know, one of the other things that you haven't talked about that's in the Tory manifesto is legislating to ensure that a form of identification must be presented before voting. So they're actually talking about bringing in that you would have to take, I don't know, your driving licence or a passport or something like that to the polling station when you go and vote.
Martin, this is just one thing which is actually eroding the electorate. Never mind, people can't even vote if they want to in some cases.
Well, more to the point, they're planning to redraw the constituency boundaries on the basis of the existing electoral registers, those who are active in the inner city know massively underestimate the number of people in the inner city.
So this is
gerrymandering of the kind which was led to war in Northern Ireland in 1969,
okay.
And the Tories are blundering into it.
Is it gerrymandering, Helen, just in one word, yes or no?
Well, I'll say yes.
Absolutely. If boundaries are redrawn without a full record and register of everybody that's there, it's not fair.
Okay, time now for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks to our guests, Labour Councillor for Hartcliffe, Helen Holland, and Lib Dem Councillor for Cotton, Anthony Negus. After the Murdoch News, we're talking economics.
From the Sky News Centre.